Strikes continued to increase, working class on the offensive. In 1960, 46 million days, man days lost through strikes. 2 years later, 182 million. That's a quadrupling of the level of strikes over a two-year period. Here the bourgeoisie, having failed to stop the movement by leaning on the fascists, were posed with the question, what do we do? And we've seen it so many times. Faced with an upsurge in the working class movement, the capitalist class is forced to turn to the very leaders of the working class and call them into government. A bit like Tony Blair in 1997. The workers were fed up with the Tories. And we've seen it many times. The conclusions they drew were that they had to call the Socialist Party into coalition with the Christian Democrats, therefore apparently shifting the balance of the government towards the left, or the centre-left. And a coalition was formed, the first centre-left coalition. That government was actually elected, in spite of being a coalition with the Christian Democrats, was elected with the proposal of a series of reforms. For instance, there was one law against monopolies and other things like that. The right wing of the Italian bourgeoisie, probably the people who are now with Berlusconi and Fini, were very concerned. And in 1964, they contemplated carrying out a military coup. The plan Solo was under General De Lorenzo. They actually had the tanks ready, the regiments ready, and they were going to call the coup. They had a plan, they already had the plan to arrest key trade union leaders, Communist Party leaders, Socialist Party leaders, shop stewards, etc., and they even knew where they were going to take them. There's the Gladio conspiracy later revealed that they had camps ready in Sardinia where they were going to take them. Now, they didn't need to carry out the coup, because what the effect of the threatened coup was, the leadership of the Socialist Party retreated and abandoned any pressure on the government to carry out reforms. There is a little parallel here. If you study the history of Italy in England, you look at the dates, there's often very similar developments. You see, in Britain, in the same period in the early 60s, you had the apprentices' strikes. Then you had Labour coming to power in 1964. There'd been a slight slowdown in the economy in 62-63. Labour was elected Prime Minister of this country. They didn't threaten a coup in Britain, but the Governor of the Bank of England went to visit Harold Wilson and said to him in his private office, either you withdraw your programme of reforms or we will organise a strike of capital. We'll create chaos in the economy. Harold Wilson, we know what he did. Instead of turning to the workers and saying that happened, he wrote it in his memoirs many years later, after having carried out an anti-working class policy. In the same period in Italy, you have the centre-left, and the pressure is applied through a coup. They abandon the programme of reforms, and one of the conditions that the coup leaders had posed was the left wing of the Socialist Party should be excluded from government, because they had some ministers. And that was what happened. Only the right wing of the Socialist Party was allowed to have ministerial positions. So we can see the bourgeoisie, faced with this movement, actually vacillated between two positions. Do we carry out a coup and impose a dictatorship, or do we use the Socialist Party leaders? The problem was, the movement was so strong from below, in those conditions a coup could have led to a civil war. They decided the best option was to lean on the Socialist Party. And in 64, there was a slowdown in the economy, and we see an increase in unemployment between 63 and 68 in the build-up to the hot autumn. Unemployment in 63 was 800,000. By 68, it was 1,200,000. And in actual fact, if you see what happened in 63-68, after the massive increase in strikes up to 62-63, you have a big decline in the level of strikes and militancy in that period, precisely because workers were losing their jobs. It wasn't an easy period to be involved in struggle. But interestingly, in Italy, 63, the Socialist Party joins the coalition with the Christian Democrats. This provokes a split to the left of the Socialist Party. It was called the PSIUP, the PSIUP. It was the Italian Socialist Party of Proletarian Unity. It split with about 100,000 members, and it took the majority of the trade union cadres of the Socialist Party with it. It was basically a centrist formation. It was similar to the ILP in Britain in the 1930s, and it moved radically to the left in that period. Now, the recession had the immediate effect of cutting across militant working class struggle. Just to give you one example, in Piedmont, which is the region of the northwest of Italy, around Turin, 60,000 workers lost their jobs in industry in that period. And after having had to sort of withstand the pressure of the working class, in that situation, the bosses went on a counter-offensive and put huge pressure again on the working class. They thought they had re-established order, put the workers back in their place. What they didn't realise was this increased pressure on the working class was simply preparing a new explosion of the Italian working class, which was to come in 68-69. As I said, the recession was 62-64. After that, there was the beginnings of an upturn, which started in 65 and led up to 69, a boom that took off again. And again, we see when there was a recession, the workers were on the defensive. As soon as the economy started taking off again, we started to see important strikes. An engineering strike in 1966, and then it led to a wave of strikes in other sectors. The workers were trying to win back in the period 66 to 68 what had been taken away from them in the period of 62 to 65. So the upturn led to a renewed confidence again. And what was interesting in this period was the workers began to see the need for democratically elected and controlled structures of the working class. In the factories, the workers starting to elect what became known as the factory councils. The factory councils are not classical shop stewards committees, i.e. a shop steward is a member of a union and elected by his union. A factory council was elected by the whole workforce, whether they were members of a union or not. And anybody could be elected delegate, not just a trade union member. The bureaucracy of unions didn't like that. They always resisted that, but the workers were insisting on that. They started to elect committees in different factories, and they started to coordinate these committees regionally and nationally. And there were disputes over wages, conditions, in all over Italy. In autumn 67, the students were affected by this radicalization, and they began to mobilize. We had a series of occupations of universities in 1967. The most famous were Trento, which is up near the Austrian border, Milan, Turin, Genoa, the three major industrial towns of Italy, and Cagliari in Sardinia. And there was a natural coming together in this process of the radicalized students and the young workers. And here we see the developing tension between the rank and file of the trade unions, the factory committees, the workers in the factories, and the leadership of the trade unions who were trying to hold this movement back. In early 68, there were strikes over pension levels. The trade union leaders were preparing to compromise. In February 68, they proposed what the workers regarded as a bad agreement. There was a ballot. The overwhelming majority of the workers voted against accepting the deal. And in March, the CGIL was forced to call a general strike. And the bureaucracy was taken aback. It was a hugely successful strike. They weren't expecting it to be there. Their idea was, it's always been this. If you can't stop the workers coming out on strike, officialise the strike and try and control it. I've actually got the quotes of union leaders actually saying this. We didn't come out to support, we came out to rein in. And they actually say that because they saw a development of the movement as a danger to the stability they were used to. The engineering workers then came out. Strikes in major plants. In March 68, 100,000 Fiat workers came out on strike. Now, the Fiat plant in the history of the Italian labour movement is important because the battles at Fiat are always fought to the end, one way or the other. Either, if you look at the history over 100 years of the Italian labour movement, you'll see that Fiat workers are either at the height of the movement, massively mobilising, or they're completely smashed and demoralised. Because being such a key sector of the class, the bourgeoisie would take on the Fiat workers. It would be an example. Defeat the Fiat workers as an example to the rest. It's what Thatcher did to the miners in Britain. But in Italy, they've done it over and over again with the Fiat workers. If you look at the history of the labour, you look at Fiat, you see the level of strikes at Fiat and the level of union membership and activity, and it's a very good thermometer at how far the radicalisation has gone in the working class. And the fact that in March 68, 100,000 Fiat workers came out was an indication of what was happening. When they started coming out, it meant that the whole class was being affected. The movement was so powerful that the bosses were forced to make concession after concession. The only way they could think, you can't intervene militarily with a coup and repression against this kind of mobilization. The only way they could think of trying to calm the workers down and get them to go back to work was to make concession after concession. But this kind of aroused working class, which through these struggles gets these concessions, the effect is the opposite of what the bosses imagine. It emboldens them. It makes them think, we are strong. We can actually achieve more than we've achieved. For example, prior to 68, in Italy, there was a thing they were called gabbie salariali, their wage cages, they were called. Basically, if you worked for a company in one part of Italy or another, you would get different wages. A little bit like the London waiting, but in Britain, it's only London and the rest of the country. In Italy, it depended on each area. And what they said, well, the cost of living in the south is lower, so workers in the south could earn less. There'd been a historical struggle of the working class to establish equal wages for everybody. And in 1968, the workers successfully got these abolished, which was a major turning point. Paradoxically, now, Berlusconi government, 40 years later, wants to reintroduce these things. They're playing with fire. I mean, I'll say something at the end. The conditions in Italy today are very, very similar to what was happening pre-68, which I think gives an indication of what is going to happen. The struggle against these culminated in a general strike and the movement of 68. And in March 69, the Italian bosses' union, the CBI, the Confindustria, actually signed an official agreement and abolished these wage differentials. And all this was giving the working class a feeling of its own immense power, and it kept going forward for more and more, considering the enormous pressure it'd been under in the previous 20 years. And this is what led to the famous Hot Autumn in 1969. Now, an interesting phenomenon, a little aside here. In the older, more traditionally unionized factories of Italy, there was the weight of the defeats of the past and the heavy hand of the bureaucracy, because it had the structures of the unions that it could use to control, actually stifled the initiative of the workers to struggle. And so what we saw in Italy, and it's not just in Italy, we've seen it in, I mean, Grumwich as an example, I think, in Britain, what one would class as more backward layers, less unionized, women workers, the South, the Catholic areas, that's precisely where you had some of the most militant struggles breaking out in 68, 69. There was one famous example of in the Veneto area, in Venice. The area around Venice is traditionally a Catholic, Christian, democratic area. And in April 68, there'd been a restructuring of the factory, speeding up of production. Real wages had gone down, and the bosses were threatening to sack 400 workers. Now, this was a factory which wasn't unionized, which was supposed to be backward. It led to an incredible explosion of anger of the workers in this factory. One of the things they did was they went to the office of the time and motion people, those that had the charts. You know, these men and women would go around with a stopwatch, and they would actually, I think they still do it, they time how much a particular job takes, and they time lots of them, then they make an average, and then they get a chart and they say, a worker in 2 hours should be able to produce so many pieces. Of course, each worker has his own strength, health, ability and all the rest of it. It put enormous pressure, and for years these workers have had to take it. They went in, they burnt the charts, got all the files out of the cabinets and burnt them, showing the absolute hatred they had of this system. And they were mainly women, and they came out, demonstrated in the city, and the police arrested 42 of them. And this was happening in more than what it was spreading. And we've seen this before in other countries, where precisely because where the bureaucracy is strongest and has more authority, especially on this older layer. And for years you'll have this unionised layer complaining about the ununionised sectors and the backward sectors. And for many years that they seem to be right. But precisely because there the bureaucracy has no influence on these factories, when the pressure reaches the point where they can no longer take it, they just explode. And there's no loyal Team G-Shot steward to say, yeah, just a minute, let's hold it. It just explodes. The effect it has, they start to unionise. Then it encourages the more traditionally organised groups of workers who were demoralised, who did lack confidence because they could see the class wasn't moving. When they see these layers move, the conclusions they draw is, we can go for it. And then it has the effect of sweeping the whole class with it. And that is what we actually saw in Italy in 68, which was preparing an even bigger movement later on. And what was happening was the trade union bureaucracy, the leadership of the trade unions, was beginning to lose control of the rank and file. This phenomenon was spreading, and there were spontaneous rank and file bodies being formed that were leading the struggles. A lot of these strikes were not led by the trade unions. In actual fact, in the first period, the unions came out against the movement. They tried to stop it and control it. In the meantime, you have the impact of May 68 in France, which we'll discuss later this afternoon. Now, what the effect of May 68 in France was that it revealed the immense power of the working class. If anybody had any lack of confidence or any scepticism about the working class, you look at what happened in May 68 and you see that the working class had control of France. And it had an effect in Italy. Now, in the Pirelli factory, the tyre factory in Milan, we have something happens in February 68. And the trade union leaders sign a rotten agreement. A very small wage increase and no improvement in conditions. In a situation where inflation was starting to take off, and the workers were not happy with that. The reaction was, June 68, they form what is called the CUB, C-U-B. It's called the United Rank and File Committee. And bureaucracy of the trade unions is taken completely by surprise. They thought it would just be a minority little movement, a little group. This committee, which was elected in that factory, started to attract mass meetings, thousands and thousands of workers. And in those meetings, what would be discussed would be a bitter attack on the Communist Party leadership, a bitter attack on the trade union leadership for the compromises that they'd forced the workers into, denouncing them in the meetings and organising strikes. And they started raising radical demands. They were demanding a shorter working week with no loss in pay. They were demanding that the factory take on more staff to alleviate the pressure on the workers. They were demanding the banning of certain toxic work involving toxic chemicals, and a big increase in wages and many more. And it looked like, if you looked at that particular snapshot of that movement, you would have said, and some what we regard as sectarians did say, this is the beginning of the end of the Italian trade unions, and these new formations will bypass the trade unions and become the alternative. And this is a big, big mistake that these various groups made. For instance, there's an article in the Italian edition of Monthly Review at that period, and they said, we are faced with a generalized overtaking or bypassing of the unions. We are facing a rejection of the policies of the unions and of the union as an instrument of mediation of class struggle. And behind this is the demand for a new type of trade union. You know, if you see what happened afterwards, that's not how things went. Initially, as I said, the trade unions tried to stop this movement. They tried to hold it back. It was so powerful, they couldn't. Now, first, they moved against. In the process of doing that, they were losing control of the movement. Now, what's the role of, from a Marxist point of view, the role of the trade union bureaucracy is, in actual fact, the policeman of the bourgeoisie inside the working class. They try and hold the workers back and try and maintain a certain stability for the bosses, but they can only do that if they have authority. If they've lost their authority, they can't hold the workers back. Where you have the working class moving massively to the left and the bureaucracy still trying to cling on to the old position, either they will lose total control of the movement and then the movement will radicalise through these committees, or they're going to have to do something to step in and win back their authority. The way they do that is they officialise the unofficial strikes. We saw this in Britain in the 70s, unofficial strikes, and then eventually the bureaucracy turns and officialises them. They've got to support the movement and also raise some of its demands and appear to be leading. That way is the only way they can regain the authority in which, through which they can then try and pull the movement back to a moderate stance. But the effect this has amongst the mass of workers is when they see the trade unions beginning to lead struggles, the workers regain their confidence in the unions and they start to join the trade unions. And the consequence is they push the unions to the left. The more workers come in this situation, the more pressure is put on the leadership of the unions, the more they've got to talk to the left, the more attractive they become outside the union. And what we see is what we've always said, they try and ride the tiger's back. They get on the tiger with the idea of trying to rein it in. Of course, a tiger's not an easy thing to rein in. On this basis of officialising the movement and becoming backed by the official unions, there were major gains of the working class in the period 1970-71. In 1970, they won a shorter working week. There was a first cut in the working week, and there was a 20% increase in wages, the biggest increase in wages of the post-war period. And the unions were even forced to go beyond the simple question of wages and conditions. They started raising the question of public transport, housing. The unions were actually starting to become politicised and forced to take on bigger issues. Now, how did the unions get around the contradiction which did exist of you have a union structure with members, and then in the factories you have the factory councils, which were the most democratic bodies that you'd ever seen in the Italian labour movement, elected by all the workers in the factory and not controlled by the bureaucracy. What they did is they gradually, first having rejected them and tried to stop them, they then recognised them and declared that the factory councils are the rank and file bodies of the union. They basically integrated them into the union and tried to bring them back within the control of the trade union, absorb them. On the legal side, the government was forced to actually recognise the status quo, and a law was passed in 1970 called the Workers' Statutes, which existed untouched for decades, which actually gave workers very important defence mechanisms. For instance, against intimidation, you couldn't sack a worker without a justified cause, and the worker could take the company to court, and many did and won those cases. It was basically a recognition of the de facto balance of forces between the classes. The state could do nothing else. And the other side of this is the political effects of all this. As I said, there was a split in the Socialist Party in 63. In 1969, right at the peak of this movement, the Italian Communist Party split, its first major split, with 100,000 members splitting to the left, forming a group called Il Manifesto, the paper still exists, a radical shift to the left. But beyond that, if you look at various little groups, various different sectarian ultra-left groups, it shows you the degree of radicalisation of the workers and youth. Just one example, a little group in 1968 called Workers' Vanguard, Avanguardia Operaia, had 100 members in 1968. In 1977, it had 8,000 members. You had a group like Lotta Continua, which started with a few university circles, 10,000 members. In 1977, Badoop, which was the remnants of the manifesto, 10,000. If you count all the various ultra-left extra-parliamentary groups in Italy in 1976-77, you could probably count about 100,000. I actually attended a conference in September 77, and they had 100,000 on the demonstration. Now, it's a tragedy if you look at it, because they were all split into different groups, all different kinds of ideas, Maoist, Stalinist, this, that, and the other. In the meantime, the Communist Party vote was growing all the time. The radicalization, which I've described inside the working class, was leading to a political radicalization. And in 1976, the Italian Communist Party reached its highest peak in votes, over 34%. The Communist Party began to grow in 1970, growing massively every year. It reached 1,800,000 and about 200,000 in the Youth League. So you had about 2 million members in the Communist Party. The trade unions, which in 68 organized 34% of the workers, and the sectarian groups were saying, right, this is the beginning of the end of the unions because all these committees are going to bypass. In 1977, the unions had 52% of the workforce in their ranks. They'd massively increased their strength on the basis of the process which I described. There was a massive movement forward of the Italian working class and the youth, and a massive shift to the left and the development of the left organisations. Now, I could give a lot more details, but I mean, I want to give some time for people to ask questions and discussion. But just to see, the 1976 elections, the massive increase in the Communist Party vote, was in politics the effect of the radicalisation which developed in 68-69. And what did the Communist Party leaders do? Exactly the same as what they did in 1944-47. Instead of building on this and moving to the left, if you added up the votes of the Communists, the Socialists, and even the ISETs, they got six MPs on the basis of this radicalisation, they were close to 50% of the votes. Now, on this basis, a genuine Socialist and Communist Party leadership would have joined forces to push for a left government. Instead, the Communist Party, what did it do? It turned the other way. It invented the idea of the historic compromise, and they didn't even enter the government of the Christian Democrats. They simply made a deal whereby they voted for everything the Christian Democrats did in government without even being there. The result was, on the Union front, sorry, there was a further shift to the right on the part of the leaders. Having regained the authority by having led all these strikes up to about 73, 74, and by that time a lot of the trade unions were very popular, they then used this authority to impose what they call a social contract, which, but the same thing was happening in Britain, by the way. It's not that strange and not that distant. The idea was, there's a recession, which was the 1974, there's unemployment, get the economy moving again, the workers have got to accept limitations on their demands. They can't ask for too high wage increase. They've got to work harder. They've got to make sacrifices to allow us to get the economy going again. Of course, it didn't do that. All it did was a massive cut in the living standards of workers. The end was, in 1979, in the elections, for the first time since 1948, the Communist Party lost votes. And it was the beginning of a process which I don't want to go into, which is actually the beginning of the process which has led to what we have today with Berlusconi. The different ultra-left groups could not understand what was going on. They were supposed to be the revolutionaries and the Communist Party were the traitors. How do you explain the victory of the Communist Party in 1976? And furthermore, how do you explain the fact that after 1976, when the Communist Party was collaborating with the Christian Democracy, and in 1977 you see an unravelling of the whole process, the trade unions start to lose members, the Communist Party between 1977 and about 85 were losing about between 80 and 100,000 members a year, if the theory of these sectarians was correct, they should have been winning tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Communist Party members. That's not what happened. Practically every single one of these sects collapsed in infighting because they didn't understand what was happening. They couldn't understand how come 100,000 leave the Communist Party, they don't join us. It led to internal fighting, factionalism, and in the end, Avanguardo Operai, Lotta Continua, all these, they disappeared. Not even a small group left of them. They were completely smashed. And here you had at least 100,000 young people and workers who had been in some kind of revolutionary group who lost hope. And if you talk to people in the 80s in Italy who had been active in the 60s and 70s, you would invariably find a very depressed individual to talk to, because they would say, we tried it, because they thought they were within, they could have taken power, and it was taken away from them. He lost the elections in 79, and as we've seen before in the past, defeated like in 1948, the bosses go on an offensive, and in Italy in 1980, you had the equivalent of the miners' strike. You had the Fiat workers on strike for 5 weeks, the whole of the Italian working class looking to the Fiat workers for a way out. They were sending food parcels, coaches for the people to go and help picket them. It was a huge struggle, and the trade union leaders betrayed. Political defeat in 79, a major defeat of the most important sector of the working class in 1980, and then from then on it was a downward road of defeat after defeat after defeat. The steel workers, the chemical workers, the building workers, one after another, and a return to the right. In 1984, they even abolished the sliding scale, because I don't know if you know, one of the victories of the revolutionary developments of the 40s was that the Italian workers imposed on the bosses the sliding scale. Now, the sliding scale, for anybody who's read the transitional program, is one of the key demands. Sliding scale of wages. Inflation 10%, wages must go up automatically by 10%. And the Italian workers had actually won that. And every 3 months, up until the 80s, the workers in Italy would get an automatic wage increase. Whether you were a member of a union or not, that gave enormous authority to the labour movement, because they won this for all of them. In 1984, they started to attack it and eventually took it away. And now we've had 20 years of just attack after attack on all the gains of the workers in 68, 69. And I have the feeling that what they're doing in Italy now, I'll just give you an idea. In Italy at the moment, according to figures of one trade union study, the number of deaths at work, workers who die in production, is 6 times higher than what it is in Britain. It gives you an idea. If you talk to some workers in Italy, they are at the limit of what they can take. This death in December of 7 workers, one of them took 24 days to die. He was burnt alive. And there was a demonstration in December. It was a rally for these workers. The unions couldn't even be bothered to call a strike in protest. They called a Saturday rally. But 20,000 workers turned up at that rally. I've got the DVD, I can show it to you one day. We can have a showing of it. I'll have to translate some of it. But you've got the faces of these workers, and you've got the trade union leaders up on the platform, and they are shouting, "Traitors, you have betrayed the working class, assassins, murderers." And the fathers of these young workers who are saying this, you've got the workers with their banners, with the trade union banners. There's a working class woman talking to the unions. They don't defend the workers anymore like they used to. This is the real anger of the working class. And I think it gives you a taste of what is to come. The hot autumn is not just history. And it's not just history for Italy. It's a lesson for today. I was reading The Guardian, and I'll finish on this, this morning. You know, they have the work supplement on Saturday. And it referred to the Grangemouth oil workers. It says, their strike, they did it in the old-fashioned way. You know, strike and rally and banners and pickets. But today, most people work with computers. I was reading it, and I was thinking, you live on another planet. You know, the real situation that's developing is Grangemouth and struggles like that. And the purpose of discussing something like this, 68, 69, is not just academic history. I mean, I like history of all kinds. But the purpose of discussing this is to actually get a feel for the historical flow of history. You know, I've tried to get a picture of what happened after the war, the different periods the working class went in, the ups and downs, the linking of the class struggle to the different ups and downs in the economy, the way the trade unions behave, the way the bourgeois behaves, the different options they've got. And to see that and to understand that the class struggle is not something of 68 or 70 or the 70s and it's all finished. After all, what I described in the 50s was not very different to what we have today. In terms of collapsing trade union membership, the members of the CGL were halved in that period, a falling number of strikes, and yet then we get this new upsurge, followed again by the defeat of the late 70s and early 80s, and a 20-year period of incredibly low level of strikes. But that's a consequence of the previous period. It's not a permanent state of the working class. The working class goes up and it goes down, depending on different events and situations. I would argue that we actually are on the verge of a new 68 in Italy. I was at a conference of our comrades in Italy a week ago, and what really struck me, and I was there with Alan, and we were discussing, I said, I listened to all the shop steward comrades, they're all in their 20s, and every single one, they work in the north, but they all have southern accents. They are southern immigrants, and there's something like 250,000 from the south move to the north every year. It started again. On top of that, you've got the immigrants from outside who will also play a role. And you hear these workers and the mood they express, and when they tell you, one of them is he's a shop student in an engineering factory in Bologna. His workmates, their attitude is, yeah, you talk about the union. Anything you say, we'll be with you. We're behind you. We trust you. But we don't trust the people at the top. We don't trust those bureaucrats. They'll betray us. That is what's developing, and you can see in it elements of 68, 69, and it will come again. Now, I've tried to give an overall historical view of the situation, and I hope comrades ask questions, and I can answer, clarify, or whatever.